It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent rodhunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Welcome to our program. It's always good to have you. So, on a previous show, you heard me talk about the rapture and the tribulation, two events associated with the second coming of Christ. And at that time, I mentioned quickly a personal theory regarding the time of Jesus' return. Today, I am going to expand. First, once again, and I cannot say this too many times, Jesus was so clear, nobody knows the day or the hour. We don't know when Jesus is returning. We don't even know that we're the last generation. It's possible he will definitely return someday. We do not know when. And this phenomenon of not being sure when is actually expounded upon more in the scriptures than people seem to think. You see, being impatient about the second coming of Jesus and doing a lot of guesswork about the second coming of Jesus is nothing new to our generation. It was going on in Jesus' day. I'm going to read now from 2 Peter. 2 Peter was one of the last letters, if not the last letter that Peter wrote. It's certainly the last letter of his that has survived. He was awaiting punishment and execution under Emperor Nero. So this is late in church history. This is about 64 AD. I say late in church history in reference to when Jesus died, which was 33 AD, but late in the sense that the apostles are starting to die off. Peter's about to die. Others have died. We know that Paul also was executed under Emperor Nero. We don't know which one went first, him or Peter, but Peter's aware of many apostles who have died already. And you need to listen to his words. Now, first of all, he talks about the last days. The Bible defines the last days not as the last generation that will see Jesus return, but the new covenant. In the beginning of the book of Acts, when all kinds of miraculous phenomena were being poured out upon the early church when the Holy Spirit came upon them, Peter says this fulfills what the prophet Joel spoke about the last days. And the last days begin with men and women and sons and daughters prophesying, and they end with the moon turning to blood and stars falling from the sky and Christ returning. So we are living in the last days. We've been in the last days for the last 2,000 years. That's not the same as the last generation. The last generation will not be able to identify itself until an event known as the seven-year tribulation, and even that we will not be able to identify, as I said before, until halfway through 3.5 years, when some bloodthirsty dictator who came along with charm and charisma and power goes into the temple, and it'll be a new temple, a rebuilt temple, sets up a throne in the Holy of Holies, proclaiming himself to actually be God and promising to execute any who do not worship him as God. You will not be allowed to buy or sell if you do not worship him as God. And in the book of Revelation, we're told that wearing the number 666 is your way of worship. Him. So back to Peter. 2 Peter 3, 3 through 8. Above all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, "Where is this coming he promised? Ever since our ancestors died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation." Skipping down to verse 8 now. "But do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance." Now, it's interesting over the years that when we read verses like this, certain words jump out at people and they make much ado about nothing, and the more important words they ignore. The much ado about nothing here is when he says one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is a day, and some people say, "Oh, so maybe it wasn't a literal six-day creation. Maybe one of God's days is 1,000 years." My friends, do you think a 6,000-year creation is going to please scientists who believe that the world is millions and millions of years old? Of course not. And that's not what Peter's trying to say anyway. That's one of the places where he's saying God is removed from time. One day is as 1,000 years, but 1,000 years is as one day. It's a nonsensical statement in the sense that it's pointing out that to God, there's no such thing as time. Time is a limitation for us. Okay, we can expand on that in a future program. The important point here is when Peter says, you may be impatient, but what's taking a long time to you is not taking all that much time to God. And the reason God is postponing the second coming, he's giving people more time to repent. And this breaks into my theory, a theory that I have scripture with which to back it up, but obviously I wish there was more, so I'll still call it a theory. I believe there have been several times throughout history where God allows the stage of the world to be set up for the second coming of Jesus Christ, but then he postpones it, giving people more time to repent. Now, what do I mean by the stage? I mean the events that need to happen. The tribulation, the persecution of Christians, the coming of the Antichrist, all the events that lead up to and culminate in the second coming. Now, you're thinking, but Bob, there's only going to be one Antichrist. Not so. There's going to be one ultimate Antichrist. There's going to be one final Antichrist. There is going to be that guy that Jesus returns and destroys. But look at these words from 1 John. This is also written very late in church history, the church history of the apostles, that is. John is still alive. He's an old man. He's writing to the church. And look at these interesting words. 1 John 2:8. Children, it is the last hour. Now again, right, last hour. See how loose they are with words like hour? That doesn't mean that it's going to happen an hour from now. It just means that from God's point of view, things are happening fast. To us, not so quickly. But anyway, we're in those last days. We're in those last, as we said, it's been going on for 2,000 years. We're in that second covenant. Children, it is the last hour, and just as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have appeared. From this, we know that it is the last hour. So there's an ultimate Antichrist, but there have already been other Antichrists. Emperor Nero was an Antichrist. He was the first emperor to persecute Christians. Did you know that in Hebrew numerology, and I'm not talking about magic numerology, I'm just saying that in ancient Hebrew, letters also signified numbers. The number for Nero's name in Hebrew numerology is 666. That's the identification of the Antichrist. And in the days of Emperor Domitian, that's when the book of Revelation was written. A lot of people say, well, God will never let his people go through persecution. God will never let Christians go through the Great Tribulation. As I mentioned last time, there will be Christians going through the Great Tribulation. And Revelation was written because Christians were already going through a kind of tribulation. It was certainly persecution. They were certainly being murdered. Emperor Domitian was claiming to be Lord and God, and he was telling people that if they didn't worship him, if they didn't go to a temple of the Roman Caesars and worship him and light incense to him as God, they would be executed. He was the most evil emperor we had had since Nero. In fact, many of the ancient Romans believed he was Nero reincarnated. Now, I don't believe in reincarnation, and the Bible does not teach reincarnation. I'm just saying that to get you into the heads of the ancient Romans. Domitian was somebody like Nero. An Antichrist is one who persecutes the church and impersonates good and claims to be God. Jesus really was God. An Antichrist will make the false claim of being God. Nero was an Antichrist. Domitian was an Antichrist. There is such a thing in Scripture as multiple fulfillment in prophecy. There is such a thing in Scripture as conditional prophecy. In the 9th chapter of Daniel, Daniel makes a prediction, and Jesus refers to this prediction, the time of his visitation to Israel. Daniel predicted the exact amount of days of which Jesus would actually come to Jerusalem, the day he would march in. And that is the day that we traditionally call Palm Sunday. That day works out to March 30th, 33 AD. But Daniel went on and made other predictions. He talked about this 7-year tribulation. He called it the abomination of desolation. He talked about somebody profaning the holy temple and going into the holy of holies. Now, a lot of times, and I have done a previous show about this, people ask me, why do we have to have two comings of Jesus? Why couldn't there have been one? Well, getting back to the idea of multiple fulfillment, getting back to the idea of conditional fulfillment, originally there was only going to be one coming of Jesus, but the Jews rejected him. Not all of them. All of his followers were Jews, but the Jewish religious leaders, the ones running the country, the puppet people running the country under the Romans, they did not accept Jesus. If they had, he still would have needed to die on the cross. And remember, if the Jewish Sanhedrin had gotten behind Jesus, then Pontius Pilate, all on his own, without anybody having to talk him into it, if they were all rallying around him, calling him king, I guarantee you, Pontius Pilate and the Romans all on their own would have crucified Jesus. They did crucify Jesus, but the Jewish Sanhedrin had to talk them into it. They would have done it all on their own. He still would have paid for our sins. He still would have risen from the dead. He was going to have to do that no matter what, because that's the only way a soul can be saved. But instead of going away, he would have stayed, and he would have set up his kingdom, and he would have banished the Romans. And in those days already, they were calling the Roman emperors gods. It's true that Domitian was the first one to take that seriously, and it's true that Nero was the first one to persecute Christians, but had there been a lot of political unrest in the name of Christianity, that could have happened from Emperor Tiberius as well. And so all those things could have been fulfilled in those days. It became postponed, partly because the people rejected Jesus, but God gave them more time to repent. When you read the book of Acts, you see many of the Pharisees, many of the Sadducees gave their lives to Jesus Christ. Paul originally was a Pharisee. He had been persecuting the church. One day Jesus appeared to him, identified himself, said, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" And then the Apostle Paul became so powerful in the church, he actually wrote half the books of our New Testament. So it could have happened right then without there even being a second coming at all. It could have happened under Nero. It could have happened under Domitian. Look at the time of Adolf Hitler. Hitler viewed Germany as a revived Roman Empire. Hitler hated and murdered the Jews, wanted to execute every Jew in Europe, and came close to doing so. But at the same time, Zionism is going on in the Middle East. The Jews are returning to their homeland. Can you just imagine the pastors in those days that must have looked at the way the world was getting set up and said, "This is it. We're on the threshold of the second coming of Christ." Well, we may have been on the threshold of the second coming of Christ, but God postponed it. Are we on the threshold of a second coming of Christ today? Do we see antichrists in the world? Could something like the Great Tribulation rise up right in our own times? Oh, yes, and so easily, and so much theater going on between Israel and the other nations, and anti-Semitism spreading all over the world, and a hatred of Israel. It could happen really easily, or God could postpone it again. Look at Jesus' words when he comes into Jerusalem, Matthew 23. "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Jesus is lamenting that Jerusalem will not accept him. As a result, Jerusalem's going to get destroyed, and it did get destroyed by the Romans. But Jesus is saying it doesn't have to happen that way. I would prefer that it not happen that way. What's the reverse of this? If they had accepted him, Jerusalem would not have been destroyed. And in similar words from Luke, he adds in the part about Daniel, Luke 19:44, "And they will level you to the ground," talking again about Jerusalem, "and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." The time of the visitation is referring to is Daniel. He talks about the abomination of desolation of Daniel, even more specifically in Matthew 24. Will there be a second coming of Christ? Yes. Could we be getting geared up for it right now? Yes. Could it happen in our time? Maybe. Could it get postponed to some other future time? Yes, as it has been for the last 2,000 years. That's my theory. Those are the scriptures I go to support the theory. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel, joined by soon-to-be dad, Brendan Thomas. Brendan, how you doing?
Very good. Very nervous now all of a sudden.
Couple of weeks, we're not going to be having you on our show.
Yeah,
we'll even have to have Jim Barrier on without his stump, Jim Barrier.
Oh, man, that's going to he's going to be like wondering, man, the third segment's here. Where's
tell
the
him it's a worthy cause. Somebody's being born.
That's right. So today I have a very, very special announcement to make. It's been, I think, over a year or two since you have given me the sequel, and I've finally come around to watching it. We are going to talk about Demetrius and the Gladiators from 1954, a sequel to The Robe.
Yes, we spent some time reviewing The Robe, and we both liked the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this sequel was made immediately afterward. It came out the next year.
Right, The Robe wasn't even released, and the studio approved of a sequel.
Plans, and it was a hit. One good thing I'll say for it right off, at least in those days, they didn't call the movie The Robe Part 2.
Exactly.
At least they gave it a different name, so let's at least give them credit for that right off the bat.
I'll give it that, but at the same time, then it's kind of hard to find the next title of the film sometimes. So I wouldn't mind like Chapter 2 of The Robe or something like that, to know that it's a continuation of it, because it's a separate title now. I don't know what, because if it was just called, you know, like Jaws, and then all of a sudden it's called The Shark is the next one. I'm like, oh, wait. What? Okay. So first, the reason why I was asking about the sequel of The Robe is because, if you remember my review, I thought Victor Mature's performance was the best in that movie. He was so awesome.
Yes.
And then that's when you mentioned,
and yet the main character in the first movie was Marcellus, and now Victor Mature is the star from start to finish.
Exactly.
This one.
Yeah, he's Demetrius. And you said, well, then you might like this next one, although you might have an issue, because one of my cons in The Robe was another character in that
movie.
You
didn't like the performance of Caligula.
No.
And there's far more Caligula in Demetrius and the Gladiators than there even was in The Robe.
Exactly. So let's get into it here. So it was written by Philip Dune, who was the same writer as The Robe, and to remind people, I've seen a couple of his other movies like Luck of the Irish from 1948 and The Count of Monte Cristo in 1934. I've seen those. It's also directed by Delmer Daves, who also directed Broken Arrow from 1950, starring James Stewart, who I think I do a pretty good impression of James Stewart still, in my opinion. But
James Stewart,
why are you talking about
Mr. Potter? You are really something. You sit here in your scurvy little office.
Who is the SNL cast member that did a really good James
Stewart? That was Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey.
Did you ever see the Lost ending of It's a Wonderful
Life? Right, and John Levitz plays
Mr.
Potts.
And George Bailey, I can explain that. Oh, it was fantastic.
The other movies he directed include the original 310 to Yuma from 1957 and 1964's Youngblood Hawk, which I thought was quite interesting.
I like that star, James Franciscus, who wasn't in a lot of movies, but I'm a big fan of his. And of course, being a writer, somebody who also writes novels, I love the story. It's about a novelist who sells his first novel.
I thought it was quite interesting. The book came out in 1962 and Hollywood quickly jumped on it.
And
like,
the
we're
book
make
is
a movie.
Much better, and the book ends differently, and the book deals much more with the McCarthy era. The book was written by Herman Woke, who went on to become famous for the novels The Winds of War and War and Remembrance.
Okay.
But Youngblood Hawk, I liked the movie. I loved the novel. So you want to check out the novel, Youngblood
Hawk. Okay, well, to be fair, there's a lot of times where the book is obviously better than the movie.
Now, 9 out of 10 times the book is better.
It also has to deal with like how you imagine the story of how you would have interpreted it that way.
It does. And these days with the mini series, they can do more justice to a novel. In the days when they had to put a whole novel into a 2-hour or 90-minute movie, it was just impossible to do justice to it.
Right. I know that there's a new Dracula movie out right now, and apparently it only takes place for one chapter of Bram Stoker's original Dracula novel.
They're trying to extend themselves up for a sequel.
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah.
But that's a better way to do it because it fleshes out the characters better and gives the pacing of the original novel better.
I could see that because my argument with, you know, Ralph Bashke's Lord of the Rings, for example, that takes over 2 books. And do you know how big those books are? Are you trying to condense it in a 90-minute film?
Oh, you mean that
film?
Original animated Lord
yes,
of the Rings?
Oh, exactly.
That was not very popular.
I know it wasn't popular.
It wasn't as bad as people say, but certainly the one that they did recently,
Peter Jackson
yeah. was much better.
You get to flesh out the
characters. There's no comparison.
Right. You get to flesh out the characters more. You get to describe the inner workings of some of their struggles.
Yeah, the first one took you through the Fellowship of the Ring and about half of the Two Towers, and they did it all in like 90 minutes or so.
So, anyways, going back to Demetrius and the Gladiators, starring Victor Mature.
Yeah, we did have to get back to
I know,
eventually,
sorry, I was going
we?
Off on a track there. Yeah. It stars Victor Mature, obviously, Susan Hayward, Michael Rennie, William Marshall, Deborah Paget, Anne Bancroft, Jay Robinson, Barry Jones, Richard Egan, and Ernest Borgnine, which, by the way, when I was watching, I was like, man, I got to go back and watch McHale's Navy, because that's all I'm hearing in his character is McHale's Navy over and over.
Well, and From Here to Eternity, where Borgnine plays one really bad villain.
He does.
And Marty, where he won the Academy Award.
That's right. Yes.
A lot of good Borgnine. And then, of course, Anne Bancroft, infamous for Mrs. Robinson.
That's
The Graduate.
I was going to get to that, and you beat me to it. So there you go.
Deborah Paget played the part of...
Oh, Paget. Oh, I thought it was Paget. Okay, Paget.
You're right. I'm not great at pronunciation either. You may be getting it right, but she was in the Ten Commandments. She played Joshua's girlfriend in the Ten Commandments.
Oh, I didn't recognize that.
Yeah.
Okay, so next time I have to look back into that again. So let me get into what I really liked about the movie. First off, the action scenes are amazing. My goodness. For 1954 and the stunt work they have to do with the tigers.
I do want to say one thing, though.
Okay.
The best gladiator movie ever made was Spartacus. I know everybody likes the movie Gladiator. I would put Spartacus as the best gladiator movie. And obviously, Demetrius was a good gladiator movie, too.
Mm-hmm. I would disagree on the whole Gladiator being the best gladiator movie because the ending is so disappointing. You go through so much with this prince in terms of how he treats that gladiator throughout the whole film. And it's a simple one quick stab of the sword and that's it. And you're done with it all of a sudden. He is such an awful character. You want to see a little bit more than that to me personally. But that's my major gripe of Gladiator because otherwise I still think it's an excellent film.
I do think Russell Crowe's a tremendous actor.
He's an excellent
actor. I have to give Spartacus the nod for best gladiator movie.
By the way, I want to say this out loud in public. I'm not naming my son Russell because of Russell Crowe. I'm tired of people saying, oh, like Russell Crowe. I'm like, no,
oh,
not
is that
like
why
that.
They made that Brussels sprout joke on the last show?
Yeah, Russell
where they
Sprout.
Take, oh, Russell
it's cute.
Sprout.
It's okay, cute. I like it. So another thing I really like, and I already described this in The Robe, is the camera work and the production. I love the wide shots of this movie, and you get to see basically the stage, I guess you could describe it, but the building that they built for the settings of everything. It is gorgeous to look at. And man, the amount of time they had to get through to build all these sets is just insane, I bet. So I want to give a huge shout out to the production team and the camera work for that reason. And then also Victor Mature's performance. Once again, I really, really enjoyed it. He's just so engaging as an actor, and he's going to get in my top 10 of favorite actors.
Okay, I'm
going
to give you another
time.
One to get back to us finally in 2 years and watch, and that is Samson and Delilah with Victor Mature as Samson.
Okay.
A lot of fun. And that was a Cecil B. DeMille, same guy that did Ten Commandments.
Would that be your favorite performance from Victor Mature?
No,
personally?
My favorite performance from him, it would be Demetrius in both of these movies, yes.
Okay. Because I wanted to talk about the other thing I really loved is Demetrius's character arc. This movie is not as strong in terms of the story itself. It really kind of...
Because the story was more or less over in the last movie,
which is the problem
with most sequels.
Here, your main focus is Caligula's wanting that robe! Oh my gosh. I'll get into his... I'll get into his performance in a second.
A little bit of overacting, I guess we can say.
A little bit?
The concept of less is more was lost on this actor.
Thank you. So what I like about his character is we get to really interpret his strength of faith. at this point, his owner, Marcellus, is that right?
You mean the original movie? Yeah, that was Marcellus, played by Richard Burton.
Right, right. His owner has been killed. Jesus Christ has been killed. And now he also has a, I think it's a love interest. It was Deborah Paget's character.
Yeah, that he thought, a love interest.
For a quick second, he thought she was dead.
And that's what led him to a crisis of faith.
Exactly. I love that internal struggle. I think that's one of the most interesting
things. Because it makes them human beings.
Exactly.
And we can relate to them better.
Exactly. So in terms of a character story arc or character stories in general, I think this movie does a much better job than The Robe. But personally, I'm more of a plot guy myself. Character stories can only hang on to me for so long. That's why I'm
more of a
story. It
would be nice to have both, a good plot and good characters.
Exactly.
Obviously, we need both.
Yes. Last thing I wanted to give a shout out to for the pros is the musical score. I love the musical score.
Same for The Robe, too. Yeah. I love the music. In fact, we've used The Robe as bumper music for our radio show.
If we had a chance to play more of the music later on sometime with Demetrius's music, it does hint at Robe music sometimes here and there to give a shout out.
Yeah, they gave
it
the same theme, but I believe it was a different composer than
exactly.
the last movie.
Yeah, and I think he still does a fantastic job with it.
Yeah, they made it very derivative of it.
Now, here's my cons about the movie. Deborah Paget, I think her performance
is too sweet.
It's too sweet, and also, man, for a poor woman, her hair and makeup is just immaculate.
Welcome to Hollywood in the golden age of Hollywood, Brendan.
Can I also say that, honestly, her performance reminds me of Richard Burton in the fact that, if you remember, I had like a disagreement with you in terms of her performance was really, really 1950-esque bland to me. I wasn't really enthralled with anything she was really doing on the screen.
Yeah. And
she's such an important character, too. Like, at least with The Robe, he's the main character, so it hurts the film a little bit more. But this one's still a really important character for Demetrius in his character arc as well. So I didn't like her performance. Obviously, I did not like Jay Robinson's performance of Caligula. I've been hinting at it all night.
Well,
here.
The way he yelled would have been fine for some of it, but what you want to do is moderate it some and be a villain in the subtle ways, too. That's what was lost on.
And what's even more hurtful is the fact that The Robe wasn't even released yet, so his criticisms, I bet, of his performance wasn't to him yet, so he's still going, okay, I'll just say over the top. And then lastly, like I said, the main story itself is just not as interesting as the characters are. Again, our main focus is just on The Robe and Caligula trying to get it back, when I really think it could have been something along more focus on Demetrius's side. Again, I love his character arc story, but we can continue on. Maybe he's going on adventures away from everyone instead of getting caught and having to fight gladiators is what I'm getting.
I also thought, much as the action sequences were good, it was a little over the top when Demetrius is in the arena and he's killing one lion after another. And it was a little too much. It was up there with James Bond jumping on top of somebody else's parachute after he's parachuted off. Right?
I can make sense. Last things I'll say about these are the interesting facts I have. Besides, the studio wanted the sequel before The Robe was even released. Victor Mature himself has stated publicly this was his least favorite role he had ever done. He also said that this role actually led him to be clinically depressed. He was actually diagnosed with that.
I wonder why that is. I actually thought it was one of his better roles.
According to him, he said he just never felt like he grew as a person from this movie. And plus, he just never liked acting, he said later on in life. Again, I personally say his acting here is much better than The Robe, but even then, I think they're both fantastic performances. I can't complain about a single thing from either side of it. So.
Now, I do want to make one historical note, and I believe I mentioned this when we talked about The Robe, but that was a while ago. Emperor Caligula never persecuted Christians.
No, yes.
He became emperor right after Tiberius. Now, they've got his character down. He was ruthless. He was bloodthirsty.
For sure.
He did hassle the Jews. He would have done these things to Christians if he could have, but Christianity hadn't really made its way to the point of Rome perceiving them as any kind of threat yet. What was going on is in The Robe, they wanted a big epic. They wanted to start with the crucifixion of Christ and end with the persecution of Christians in Rome, and they just didn't have enough time historically to do that. So what would have been Nero, they made Caligula, but Caligula was a lot like Nero, so I'm fine with it. I don't mind the historical liberty, but since we're a program about the Bible, I do want to point that out to
the audience. Of course, and I bet Caligula would be like, why am I screaming so much in this movie? I don't scream this much.
This is a piece of trivia. Are you much of a Star Trek fan, the original one with Captain Kirk?
I am familiar with it, but does that something to do with Jay Robinson?
There was an episode called Ellen of Troyes. It was like a takeoff of The Taming of the Shrew, and it was this woman that had to be tamed, and Jay Robinson plays the diplomat who's supposed to tame her.
Okay.
And he's not yelling and screaming as much as Caligula, and this was made years after The Robe, and he was actually pretty good.
Okay, I'll take a look into that, because I'm familiar with the Shrew episode for sure.
Yeah, he says, Captain, when I'm around them, I do not want to educate them. I want to kill kill them. He was pretty funny in that role.
I was going to say, I know that Jay Robinson, I looked it up, his filmography. He was in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I thought he would have been more over the top than Pee-wee, possibly.
Now, I saw that years ago. I do not recall him being in it. But
he has a small, his role was cook. So he had a very small
I understood that he got into some trouble with the law after the Robin Demetrius and was in jail for a while. And obviously that put a dent in his career.
Probably, I'm assuming. And then lastly, the movie cost $2 million to make and it made $26 million in the box office. So huge profit. Not that we see a lot of profit from other films these days in the box office because ticket prices are expensive as all get out all of a sudden. I don't get why I need to spend $28 to go see one movie. I'm going to go to the $8 movie theater down the road.
But I'll say this, you could watch the movie in the theater during those days without sitting next to somebody who's texting or letting their cell phone ring.
Yeah, or talking really loudly. Thank you. So overall, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
That's not bad.
And I will give it an
average.
But
you would agree that it was not quite as good as
the
role.
Definitely not. I think I gave that movie an 8 out of 10, if not a 9 out of 10.
That was a wonderful film.
Yeah, and I'm overall, if I had to do a letter grade, because you do letter grades, I believe, for your ratings, I give it a C, personally,
okay,
for me.
Okay.
So what would you give the movie overall out of the grade?
Somewhere between C and B minus. A fun movie. Like I've told you, I'm not a big fan of sequels unless something was designed as a series from the beginning, like Star Wars was. And when they're only making a sequel because the first one makes money, it's kind of a disingenuous story. So I think this falls into that category. But having said that, it's a lot of fun. I like Victor Mature. I'm also a big fan of Michael Rennie, who's most popular for being in The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Not
that idiotic Keanu Reeves global warming version.
No, I can't say that one either.
The real version.
Yes, I know. So overall, again, we like the film. If you haven't seen it, then definitely check it out. Coming up, we are going to be talking about an Up TV original movie. So you've talked about how you don't like Hallmark movies. Well, we're going to see how Up TV does in terms of their movies.
Yes, and my lovely wife Dana watches Up movies as well.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about those.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric.
Looking for a book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a 6-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? To alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
listening to The Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Pop culture right now. Say hello again to my producer, Brendan Thomas.
So my wife has been having control of the remote as of late because she's pregnant. I'm like, oh, I don't want to upset her.
Is this an algebraic equation? Woman with control of remote equals Hallmark movie?
Something like that, yes. Or Up movie? Up movie for this case, yeah. So we watched two movies, one of which I wanted to talk about specifically. We watched Christmas Wedding Planner, which was a generic, forgettable, don't even remember movie. And while I was watching it, I was like, man, this seems like just like the cheesiest Hallmark movie I've seen in a while.
Did they have the almost kiss that was interrupted?
That's right. That's one of those things. And so I looked
at the big misunderstanding the last half hour of the movie.
Oh, yes, for sure. And when I looked it up, I was like, wait a second. This says it's an Up TV original movie.
I'm like, hey, my dream job was just offered to me, but I've got to be back before Christmas Eve or the whole job is off.
Well, in this case, what happens is they go out on a romantic date. Everything's going fine. Then he says, oh, man, what if she really doesn't actually like me? What if she's just there and then she has to leave again? Oh, well, I can't see her anymore. And then he goes to the bartender and the bartender's like, no, she really does like you. Go see her. And he goes, okay. I'm like, you wasted 15 minutes of my movie
time? Now, Brandon, here's a piece of important trivia. Somebody was actually paid money to write that script and they were probably paid a lot of money to write that script.
I bet you he was 15 minutes short and he was like, how am I going to end this? Or, oh, I can have one more scene where he gets a conflict. Maybe that'll stretch me out to the 90-minute mark. But anyway, so I wanted to talk about, it's from the same director, surprisingly enough. Justin G. Dick is his name. This movie was called Love Alaska. It was made in 2019. For those of you who don't know about Up TV, they are another one of those TV channels that's very similar to Hallmark when it comes to like the drama and the romance.
They sometimes have a little more of a twist than Hallmark, but they are very similar.
Yes. They'll sometimes try to push more religious aspects into their stuff because they were formerly known as the Gospel Music Channel way back in the day.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. Yeah.
Then eventually they started decreasing their music playing like MTV and CMT these days, and they started putting in their own original programming, henceforth why they have these original movies. So, Love Alaska. Tell me stop when you've heard of this story before. A single woman goes to a place where there's going to be a romantic getaway there, but she wants to stay single, and she does not want to fall in love with anybody.
At the beginning, I'm done with romance. And then they meet somebody that they don't get along with at first.
Oh, sort of. Actually,
and if they're already engaged to somebody, you know that guy ain't going to last the whole movie. It's going to be this new guy that's kind of cruddy.
So then, I guess you could tell me to stop then in that case. Yes. So,
I was going to say stop before you started, but I didn't want to be rude.
So no, in this case, this woman is a single woman and she reiterates it over and over. I'm a single woman. I don't need any man. I'm a single woman. And so she just graduated being a doctor and she's going to be going up to this city called Love, Alaska because her uncle passed away and he passed down a house to her.
Yes, there's the inheritance thing.
Correct,
too,
yes. So
and she wants to sell it, but then she falls in love with it.
Oh, not
and it changes her life.
Not particularly here in this movie. She's going to be opening up, and you're going to get tired of this word. I'm going to be opening up my clinic. I'm going to be opening up my clinic. I'm going to be opening up my clinic over and over and over. Oh my gosh, you just hit copy and paste over and over on your script, I bet, too, as well. Anyway, so right there and there, when she lands in Love, Alaska, she recognizes her childhood love interest all of a sudden again. And so when they go to read the will, he's invited into the room and they said that, oh, since he took care of your uncle during his dying days, he's passed on some money onto him. But he says he can only give you the house and the money if you guys work together and open up the clinic together. Henceforth, how the relationship blossoms. They have to work together and settle their differences that they had as children back in the day. And man, oh man, this is tedious, to say the least, to sit through all this time. But my wife is loving every minute of it. She's crying at the end. Woohoo, this is so happy. And such
I think your wife and my wife would get along just great.
I think so. When it comes to those Hallmark, or in this case, Up TV movies, this is where it's all about for sure for them. So I do have some pros about the movie here. The main guy character, played by Victor Deminsky, I think is his name, but he's been in a ton of other Hallmark original movies, so you'll recognize his face, or your wife will recognize his face for sure. He plays this character who has PTSD. When the PTSD kicks in, I think the film is shot really kind of interesting, especially for a TV film. It's like a handheld camcorder and it's shaking around his face and he's dealing with all the stress around him because as soon as a loud noise hits, that's when his PTSD kicks in. And I think that's quite interesting. How does this movie interact with his PTSD exactly is the question. Like, how do they solve his PTSD? You see it off screen. He goes into a story. He's like, hey, by the way, thank you for letting me talk to this therapist. My PTSD is completely gone. I don't have any anymore. So thank you so much for letting me do that. I don't think one simple therapy session is going to get rid of your PTSD, dude, but whatever. These writers seem to think so, apparently. I also mentioned that another pro is that all the performances are okay. There's not really bad acting when it comes to these films. It's just annoying character.
Well, if they have a 12 for a dollar script, then there's only so much they can do with
it. Right, right. Now this leads to my con. So here we go. Buckle in for these things.
You look a lot more excited about the cons than you did about the pros.
I do. So we have really annoying characters. So let's start off with Lynette Ware is her name, the actress. She plays Mayor Hazel. Every time she comes into the scene, she's having this baked good in her hand. Hey, I just baked you a pie. Hey, I baked you this pastry dish. Hey, I just baked you this cookie. And I just wanted to come and talk to you here. So you two are going to get into a relationship over and
That's
over.
That's the
and
other ingredient, the person that sees them together before they see themselves together.
Why are you pushing this on them so hard? Calm down. Let them do their own natural thing. You don't need to keep shoving in pastry dishes every time you walk in and say, hey, you're not going to get these pieces of pie unless you talk to that girl. Fine, I'll go talk to her. We have another character. Her name is Emma, and she's played by Kim Johnson Herhavec, I believe. But she is this foreigner that decides to go to Love, Alaska. The actual plot itself is once a year, they have this whole week where a bunch of desperate lovers go into town called Operation Love, and they try to find the love of their life over there. And it always has worked. There's always been a success rate, allegedly. I don't know. They say in the movie it is true, but I think it's just allegedly, personally. You can't fall in love with someone within that 1 week and say, oh, I'm going to marry them. But it happens not once, not twice, but three times in the movie. So have fun with that while you have your head spinning around and craziness with that. Emma seems like a normal character. She's just there to find some kind of love for her. And then she goes on a date with our main guy character because she won a bidding contest to raise money for the homeless people in Alaska. And so they go on their date, and all of a sudden her character switches all of a sudden. Oh, I love cats. Look at all my cat binders that I have everywhere and all these cat photos everywhere too. Where is this coming from? Where is this character out of the blue coming around? They don't transition that character into that kind of crazy cat lady person.
You think this was written on that new computer program that writes scripts?
The AI generated ones, probably. So what do crazy women like? Oh, cats. Perfect. Okay, we'll put that in the movie. Joey Fatone, if you don't know him, he used to be a member of NSYNC. He's in this movie too. He's actually not that bad of an actor, in my opinion. He was really good in The Christmas Wedding Planner. He was the bartender. He played himself. He's very naturally charismatic. He does nothing wrong. But this movie, for some reason, 75% of him has him overreacting, making faces, looking around like, ooh, I don't know what's going on. Oh, wait, you like pastries? Let me text that. She likes pastries sent to my mom and stuff like that. That's the big joke of his. And then the very last scene in the movie is where two main characters have a wedding and they go off onto the distance. And then Emma and Hank, who is played by Joey Fatone, Hank is his character name, they're like, what are they doing? And Hank goes, they're in love. And we're in love too. So everything's okay today. And that's the most normal line he's ever said in the entire movie. Why was that not his personality? See, the other thing I have here is that the storylines are just where the writers feel like they're just comfortable with everything. For example, I thought they could have done more with the PTSD thing. Like, let's say, for example, the PTSD really affects their relationship all of a sudden. I would like to see that because that's a real life thing that people have to go through. Many people in the military who go off on deployment and they come back, they suffer through PTSD. How do those marriages make it through with all that stuff that happens and all the stress that could come about in that relationship? I would like to explore that more, but they just say one therapy session, he's cured of the PTSD. I don't like how the characters are meeting with each other because they recognize each other. It's been 20 years since these characters met. I would have liked it more if they would hint at it and eventually they would recognize each other. Like, wait, are you? No, are you? And then they start kindling together about like reminiscing about the old times that they had together back when they were 12 years old or whatever age they were back in the day. So that's something I think I could have done, because otherwise what they did in the movie was like, hey, you're this person. Hey, you're this person. And then that's it. I'd rather have that part of the movie in there, because otherwise the ending of the film is again your last minute struggle where he goes, listen, I'm going through PTSD and so there's no way I want to hurt you more again, so I'm leaving. Even though he never hurt her throughout the movie, whenever he had PTSD he just left the room and that's it, and he's breathing outside. That's every single time he has PTSD. So it's not adding anything to their relationship per se in terms of like saying she's getting hurt by him by walking out of the room very quickly. She could just easily walk into the room and like, hey, are you okay? Do you want to talk about it? Do you want me to call the therapist? That sort of thing, but we don't get that. And also, lastly, I'm going to say that the chemistry is just not there between our main characters, honestly. I can't remember any Hallmark movies where I'm like not believing in their chemistry, but this movie here, I'm definitely telling you, I don't believe their chemistry in the slightest. So overall, I'm giving this movie a 4 out of 10. I'm giving it a D rating. I don't recommend it.
So even Jay Robinson does better than this one.
I don't go that far. Hold on. Whoa. Slow your horses there. All right. So we are coming close to near the time here. So I won't take a commercial in between. I'll just transition to this one. Disney is going to come out with a new show. It's called Oye Primos, and it's getting a lot of controversy as of late, especially with the Disney audience. So they only uploaded the intro of the show. That's it. So the show hasn't even come out with episodes or anything like that, and the people are very
upset. What's the controversy?
So we'll start off with this, the translation people are upset with. Oye Primos means welcome cousins. However, Oye is singular, is what they're saying. And so the audience is very upset because they're teaching children the wrong grammatical versions of welcome. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, Spanish is such a, it's a language where it can mean a lot of different things, and well, it's changed over time.
Woke controversy of Disney these days, I'm not sure this one would rise to a concerning level with me.
Oh.
Not this thing about the title.
No. Most of the stuff I'm going to read, I bet you won't see it as much, but these other people are just being outraged over the smallest of things. Here's the other one. Audience are upset with some of the cousins' names. For example, there's a little girl named Poquina, which is Spanish for small and cute. However, Spanish slang can also mean it as an inappropriate term in Spanish as well. And I had no idea about that.
Yeah.
And again, it's only slang in one part of Mexico. That's it. And it's a very small
part
of Mexico.
Now, is there a division? Are there other people in the Spanish community defending it? Or
yes, they're okay. They're saying, like,
they're
never...
hey, what's the big deal?
They're saying, wait, what's the slang term? We've never heard of this slang term before where you're talking about. It means small and cute, but people
sometimes
are still finding
sometimes people
a way.
Get offended on behalf of a people group. Like, I remember the Native Americans don't mind when football teams and baseball teams name themselves the Braves. It's everybody else getting offended
right.
on their behalf.
Or the Chiefs. Or
yeah.
And they were okay with the Cleveland. Indians,
yeah.
Up in North Dakota.
Some of them felt flattered that they were included.
Right. Up in North Dakota, my dad's high school team, they were originally called the Midgets, and they literally would have the smallest person.
Can't say that anymore.
No. But next thing you know, now they're called the Indians, and usually you're supposed to call Native Americans or something like that. No, but the tribe has actually celebrated that term as Indians. They're okay with the high school being called Indians. So, again, these are people just overreacting.
Well, they were called Indians for years, and yeah, it's because Columbus made a mistake and
right.
thought he was in India, but that's still what they were called, so why pretend it never happened?
Right. Here's another one. The name of the city that the show takes place in is called Terremoto Heights, which it translates into Earthquake Heights. And the audience were relating that to an earthquake that happened in 2017 where the creator of the show grew up and it killed over 300 people. I don't think she was referencing that in the slightest. The show itself takes place here in specifically in the Los Angeles area of California. And earthquakes happen quite often. Do I think they should have changed the show's name possibly to something else other than Earthquake City? Sure, but you're honestly nitpicking at this point when you keep nitpicking, like, oh, why did you call this Thunderstorm area? You know this area floods all the time here in San Diego. How could you call this Thunderstorm neighborhood? How dare you? And blah, blah, blah. And then also, another thing people have pointed out were their shoes on a power line. I did not know this one here. Apparently, that means there's gains in the area, so they're setting up a drive-by shooting, or maybe someone passed away in that area, so they put shoes to remember them by. I don't remember that. I just remember as a kid, I would throw shoes up on a power line just to hang them because I thought it looked cool. Honestly, I don't think that there's anything else besides that. And the creator herself has stated that she did that as a kid. That's why she put it into the show. She didn't have any gay
relations. Sometimes times change and different things mean different things to different people.
Right. So here's where we get to some more controversial stuff. One of the crew members on the show has called Mexico a S-word place to live. And when he went to defend himself, he said, I was using it as a sarcastic statement. It was National Sarcasm Day. But you can never tell that in a text message. So you really need to add quotes, italicize something if you're going to be joking like that, because this is a serious topic. And you're on a show with nothing but Mexican stars on the show itself. So not the smartest idea to actually put that on your show, I would say. Another thing that made people upset were they thought that the TV show is stereotyping because all these cousins live under one house, and it's a stereotype where all Mexicans live in one house. one house where it's very jam-packed to the rafters. But again, the creator has said, well, that's the way I grew up. I had so many people living.
If it's semi-autobiographical, then that's a different story.
I agree. Again, so lay off a bit, please. Just a little bit. And then the last thing people are upset are the color schemes of the show, because the actual backgrounds are all yellow, which is supposed to represent smog. But people have said that the yellow has always been in the Mexican culture as a poor way of showing how the community's always been polluted in the area. When you look at reality, that's really clear. I don't know. Personally, whenever I went to TJ, it's always been kind of polluted.
Folks, there's so many real problems with Disney these days. Go after the Buzz Lightyear movies. Don't make a big deal out of this stuff.
I agree. So the last thing I will mention is that this movie's premise is very similar to Nickelodeon's show, The Casa Grandes, which involves a lot of Latinos stuck in one giant house, basically, and they're going on different adventures. But according to the creator, she says it's actually about how the main character of the show is trying to figure out how she's so special from all of her cousins, which is just a direct copy of Disney's Encanto that came out 2021. So you're not really coming up with an original concept on that part. So especially if it's only been 2 years since that came out. So if you want to look more into it, again, it's called Oye Prumos. You can look into it. But otherwise, I'm going to state that Disney's not going to cancel it, but they're going to push back, and they're going to do a lot of screen testing to make sure that the Latino community's happier than what we have right now. So anyways, thank you so much, Bob, for this wonderful conversation.
Oh, great.
We had tonight.
And send us a text when the baby's born so we can celebrate with
you. I sure will.
All right, my friend. God bless you. We'll see you next week, everybody.